Hope by Xavier Montoya and read by Peter Shillingford. I'm trash. It's hard to say that, I know, but I have to admit it. I've lied to myself too often, and it's time to accept it. It's a matter of life and death for me. I'm real trash, and if I really want to stop being it, I must accept it first, just as a drunk has to accept his drunkenness. It is indispensable if I want to move forward with my treatment. Without it, everything else would be useless. Being the son of an alcoholic father taught me that. He drank every day, at lunch, in the evening, when he and his friends went from bar to bar, and at dinner. Any excuse was enough to pick up a bottle. And whenever Mum, an aunt, or any of us accused him of drinking too much, he used to get angry. Apparently his father had used to drink in just the same way, and even so, he passed away in his sleep at the age of 93, his mind still lucid. In other words, he had died of old age. Nevertheless, my father died 38 years earlier than his father, as a result of flu, during which his battered kidneys failed. I'd like to say that his death didn't hurt me, but that'd be a lie. Even though he was a clumsy, careless husband and father, he was a good man. It's also true that he cared more about his friends than about us. Nevertheless, what I feel now is completely different from what I used to feel back then. I was a young man who had to hate his father. My age required me to do so, just as it will force our little son to hate me someday. And I'll be happy, no doubt about it, because it will mean that we're still alive, although I do know that dead people too can be hated. Cocaine is the only drug I've ever liked. Alcohol has never attracted me, probably because of my dad. Neither has hashish, because it makes me too relaxed. And during the AIDS period, heroin had already lost the charm it once had. I began with amphetamines. Cocaine came later. I must have been 15 or 16 when I first snorted speed. It happened during the main festivities in Bilbao. We were allowed to party all night, and we had to make the most of that. After lunch, we met at the bar in Santucho that we used to frequent. After pooling the money our parents had given us, we went down to Somera Street and bought speed there. Some people wanted to snort it right away, but most of us decided to save it for the night as there was an amazing rock concert in Gas Square. We spent almost the whole afternoon in open-air bars, and we were still there, by then quite drunk, when the fireworks began. In Gas Square, we were in the first row, and yelling and clapping, shaking our heads in time to the music of a heavy metal band whose name I have forgotten. It was like we wanted to get rid of our heads. Pushing each other, we jumped and hopped around tirelessly. It was amazing. Unfortunately, it was as short-lasting as it was amazing, and the time to go home came sooner than expected. We all looked at our watches. We couldn't believe that time had gone by so fast, so unnoticed. Although we had spent all our time talking, there were still many interesting topics that we hadn't managed to talk about. And the following morning, unable to fall asleep, I made a list of the things that we should all discuss in the evening. We never had enough time. Too many things were happening around us, and we didn't have time to talk about all of them. We were so busy, especially with girls. Sometimes we used to go to Archanda to spy on the couples. We hardly saw anything since couples used to do their things in cars and not outside. They used to go there at night, so we seldom got the chance to see anything. But it made everything even more attractive to us. What we couldn't see with our own eyes became even more beautiful and more interesting for our minds. Just a few centimetres of a woman's body was enough to remind us of what we used to love about porn magazines. "They're having oral sex," Julio used to tell us, and that was enough for us to see the same thing as he was. Julio was the oldest of us all, and though he was only a year older, we used to see him as one of the smartest people in the world, even more intelligent than any parent or teacher, of course. I met Begonia during Bilbao's main festivities, but not the same year I first tried speed, 3 years later, when one of her friends began dating Julio. I hardly remember anything about that day, and the few things that I remember have little to do with what Begonia told me. I guess that we spoke that day, and according to Begonia, for some length. It was she who came up to me, I'm pretty sure of that, because I've been a shy person since I was a child, especially with girls. Nevertheless, I haven't forgotten that she was wearing yellow that day, nor how beautiful she was. Unfortunately, we didn't see each other again for a year. I sometimes ask Garbine, Julio's girlfriend, about her friend, but always indirectly. Probably afraid of getting my heart broken, I didn't want to express my feelings. "She's in Barcelona," was always Garbine's answer. She was studying there and rarely came back to Bilbao. That is why we didn't see each other for a year, and another year went by until something that happens in dreams really happened to me. Unlike that night 2 years before, I really do remember our first kiss. Rupert Ordorica was going to play in New Square and Cortato, or were they negogoriak by then, in Gas Square. The girls wanted to go to the new square, and we, the guys, to Gas. We reached a compromise in the end, and we decided to go to both concerts. By the time we finally got to Gas, I didn't care about Cortato, Negogoriak, or any other band in the world. I needed both my ears to listen to Begonia's words. I needed my whole body for her, a body that was on edge by then. I offered Begonia some speed, and although she firmly denies it, I know that happened. As if pushed by the speed we snorted that night, we spent the whole summer together until she returned to Barcelona. And later on too, because I went to visit her at least once a month. She was studying design and lived with some other Basque students near Bourne Market. We used to spend almost the whole day in bed. We only ever left home at night, mainly to eat something or to take a walk holding hands in our beloved Gothic district. That's how we spent a year. Begonia returned to Bilbao then to work. I was working as an electrician by then. I'd always been bad at school, and I got into the world of lighting thanks to the little I learned when I was forced to study electronics. I began working as an assistant to a theatre company that was as poor as I was. We used to move from town to town, earning very little but enjoying ourselves a lot. Some small lights and pieces of coloured paper were enough to create the atmosphere the play needed. We were able to create both day and night from nothing. We were little gods. I learned a lot with them, and not only about lighting matters, thanks to what I heard during the long hours in the van. I'm also indebted to a workmate from that time for the chance to get into the film business. He spoke to me about the director of a short film he was starring in. The film was called Texas, and it was about the last hours of a prisoner who had long been sentenced to death. It was awful, really awful. Nevertheless, they called me again to work on another short film, and another soon afterwards. Unfortunately for me, that time in film also meant consuming cocaine. Cocaine was as necessary as cameras, travelling and lights. In order to save money, cameras were handheld, natural light was used and amateur actors were hired. But there were no limits when it came to cocaine. They used it a lot, even when filming an unknown director's first short film. It was as if that white powered and made the director a director, rather than his or her talent or work. The same could be said for actors, cameras and assistants, and also about lighting technicians, no doubt about that. Those first years were amazing, full of laughter, work and parties. Begonia and I moved to an apartment we rented in Errekalde. Both of us were working, so we bought a second-hand car to go to the mountains and go on holiday. Begonia and I got together at a time in which many couples were breaking up, so not being able to understand that we were still in love, many people were surprised to see us. We certainly used to have big rows, but after each of them, our relationship was relit once more. We too were amazed, so much so that we would sometimes talk about getting married. We lived together as if we were married, and even so, we used to play with that idea, particularly in those periods of calm after the storm. A wedding was the greatest sacrifice that could be made at the altar of love, the guarantee of permanent happiness in our relationship. We talked a lot and we finally decided that when we had our firstborn child, we'd go to the city hall to get married. And we started making calculations, trying to guess the best moment to have that son or daughter. Naturally, we needed some money, but we realised that within a year we'd have enough. We went out to dinner to celebrate, and while waiting for the coffee, Begonia wrote in her red notebook that she would stop taking the pill on the 5th of May. However, a year later she was still taking the pill, although I asked her to stop again and again. Begonia isn't stubborn by nature, but it was clear that she had no intention of giving in on that. She loved me, she wanted to have a child with me, but she didn't want his or her son's father to be a drug addict. We had huge rows because of that. I told her that everything was getting out of proportion. I did like cocaine, that was true, but I wasn't addicted. She said that I was, and I should try living without snorting anything and see what would happen to me. At first, I asked her to leave me alone, but I quickly realised that she was going to carry on like that, so I accepted her challenge. Accepted and lost too, because the hellish dust really got me tied down. It was very difficult to see people around you sniffing lines and say no to their offers. More than difficult, it was impossible. Far from distancing me from cocaine, the recognition of my addiction tied me more closely to it. I found it hard to admit that, very hard, and cocaine was the only thing that could lift me from that depression. At that time, I went to Madrid more and more for work reasons. Back then, very few films were being made in the Basque country, and many Basque producers and directors went off to the capital of Spain. We, the technicians, were forced to go along with them. Nevertheless, I tried to spend the weekends with Begonia in Bilbao. Begonia tried not to mention the topic of cocaine or the child and not to get angry, thinking that the 2 days we had together would pass quickly. However, we both knew that that was where the crux of our relationship lay. Although she said nothing in words, I read in her eyes the message she was constantly sending me. At least, I thought so. Nowadays, however, I doubt it. It could also have been a kind of paranoia old cocaine addicts have. And to be honest, I had some of them. In Madrid, above all. Because of ETA, the police closely monitored the Basques living there, especially young people. The police scared more than one person returning home at dawn or stopped them on the street. So fear soon spread among us. I felt myself spied on in every corner and every bar. It seemed to me that they were coming after me, and just in case, I used to try to be with somebody. My paranoia grew to such an extent that one day I decided that I could no longer deal with it and that I'd return to Bilbao as soon as I finished the section of the series I was working on. I'd done the right thing. Everything was easier beside Begonia. Soon I was better, calmer, happier. I was so happy and optimistic, so ready to change, that I promised her I'd give up cocaine. She heard my promise with pleasure, although she asked me to be quiet, reminding me that I was repeating the same thing I'd promised 1,000 times before. To tell the truth, I had told her the same thing many times, too many times, but always honestly and truthfully, as truthful as it was futile. I found Begonia's attitude understandable. Warnings about crying wolf had been given time and again, but it had never appeared. So who would believe me? She asked me to prove that my promise wasn't in vain. Some proof? What was she talking about? You have to join Proyecto Hombre, she told me then. I agreed, as if she had asked me to go to the cinema. I knew hardly anything about the organisation. I thought it was for junkies, and to see myself next to them wasn't easy. I had accepted Begonia's proposal, mostly to keep her happy. She organised everything, gathering information, calling and talking with them. They showed me into a brightly lit office. Begonia was waiting for me outside. A bearded man called Ramon Goiti held out his hand to me. He had grey hair around his mouth and the rest of his beard was black. He was wearing a gold chain around his neck, which, I reckoned, held an image of Christ or of the Virgin Mary. First of all, he told me that Begonia had already told him what my problem was. However, he said, what I had to say was much more important than what my wife, he used that word, had told him. But I didn't have much to say, just a single sentence. I want to give up cocaine. I told him a lot of things, everything. However, Goite wanted more. I would happily have told him more, but I had nothing more to say. And even though I examined every corner of my dim brain, nothing seemed to satisfy the man with the pop art beard. He went on asking and asking me, never getting tired. He went on asking similar questions, trying every time to change the way he asked them. I decided to take it easy. He'd get tired at some point. Stupid me. Goiti, like everyone at Proyecto Hombre in general, was tireless. Tireless, not foolish. What Goiti wanted was clear, to prove that they can change trash like me into human beings through endless interrogation. When I got out of there, I was surprised to hear Begonia say that I had only spent 30 minutes in the office. My first 30 minutes with Goiti. The first time for many things. I had to go to that house in Deusto 6 or 7 times. I saw Goiti every time. He gave me a high five, asked how I was, and then restarted the endless questioning where he had left it off the day before. Maybe it was because of my paranoia, but he scared me a bit. The situation reminded me of a horror film which had scared me when I was young. In that film I had seen on television one winter, the time didn't change. It was always the same time on the clock at the church, on the town hall, at school, at factories, at shops and at home. But one day Goiti told me that they were going to accept me, to my surprise and Begonia's delight. Stupid me, I had no idea what was coming. I won't talk about the sheer hell of my withdrawal syndrome, because the very thought of it makes me sick. It was horrible. And what came after was not much easier either. They took my phone, cards and all my money away. Begonia had to go with me wherever I went. They forced me to leave my job and abandon my friends. They banned alcohol. Thankfully, at least, I was allowed to smoke. As well as that, and as if that wasn't enough, I had to live in the community, as they called it, for 5 months. Except for the days that I slept there, twice a week generally, I spent all day there until I returned home at dusk. Instead of the bearded Goiti, a bitter woman took care of me. Her name was Edurne. She probably wasn't all that intelligent, but she knew what she had to do after having spent so many years with people like me. At first, she seemed a bit like a nun to me, but my fellow inmates told me that she wasn't. In fact, she was married. There were 10 of us, more or less, repentant cocaine addicts. We got along with each other, which was just as well as we spent all day together. When we weren't at work, watching TV or playing chess or Ludo, card games were completely forbidden, we talked, told each other about our lives, laying open all our nooks and crannies, often under Edurne's strict gaze. Thinking has never been my main activity. Mostly I've just gone on with living, taking things as they come and carrying on. There, though, they forced us to think about my mum, my dad, my wife, myself. I had to think about all of that until I had a headache, until I was exhausted. I examined my inner self and found a black hole there whose very existence I had never suspected. And what a stench. It was disgusting. Then I had to admit for the first time what I now know so well. I was trash. I am trash. Mum, Dad, Begonia, I had been selfish with all three of them. Mum loved me unconditionally. I was the eldest of her children, and probably I was the only one she had ever wished for. Dad, on the other hand, I had hated. Luckily, it was there that I realised that his harshness had been put on just for the sake of appearances. And I started to love him, because somehow I understood that he had been as weak as I was. In fact, everyone was there like that, even if we thought otherwise. Yes, we had no will. We were incapable of looking reality in the eye from behind our mask of bon vivants. Without realising it, we were devotees of death. Knowing that we were all full of shit brought us closer together. However, Edurne thought that that kind of solidarity, even if it was beautiful, could also be dangerous. The group helped us, of course, but it also allowed us to feel comfortable there. There was no danger in that, I thought, as long as Edurne was present. More than one of us was thrown out and more than one left, no longer being able to cope with the lifestyle. I spent months talking non-stop on a trip that led me into the past. The past is a cold place, nowhere near the warm realm of our memories. It must have been difficult for our parents back then when everything had been scarce. There had been too much of a struggle sending their children to school to have time to worry about our traumas. Few people even knew what that word meant back then. Anyway, I decided that if I ever had children, I would try to protect them from any type of trauma, just in case. And if it was a girl, so much the better. Begonia would make sure she didn't become my clone. Those were the kinds of things I thought about again and again. Hopefully, and why not admit it, I was a little scared too. Begonia was aware of my thoughts, but she didn't mind if it was a girl or a boy, as long as it was healthy. I told her we would call her Dorleta, thinking of someone I met at school when I was little. She was all right with that, as long as it was a girl. However, she added, you'll have to finish up Proyecto Hombre before any of that happens. Throughout those long months, I did make progress on the endless road of getting better, too. Reintegration was the name they had for the moment when I would be free and healthy again. At the time, my most important challenge was getting a job, one that would have nothing to do with the last one I had. So I started searching, but as I had left school young as I could, nobody wanted me. Every morning I bought the newspaper, looked at the jobs page and started to phone around. Sometimes they told me to call again, saying it might not be long before they needed someone like me. Other times they didn't even say that. I even went to the job office. Having to spend my days like that was awful. Edurne, as well as Begonia, used to tell me to relax, saying I would find something before it was too late. It's easy to say that, but as the days went by, it was hard for Begonia finding me in front of the TV whenever she came home for work. It was hard for both of us. She tried to pretend, tried to hide what she felt and to appear to be happy so that I wouldn't sink even further. I spent weeks that day, until one afternoon, Begonia told me that she had a job for me. They needed someone at her brother-in-law's shop. Rafa, Begonia's sister's husband, has a shop in Indaucho. He sells flowers. He received the clients and placed their orders, and I tried to prepare them as best I could, arranging the bouquets of flowers following Rafa's orders. I mixed different kinds and colours. I watered and cleaned them. I wrapped them in the paper in different ways depending on each order because of wedding bouquets and funeral bouquets aren't the same, obviously. Sometimes I worked at the back of the shop. Other times, however, I took the van and delivered the flowers. It isn't the worst job there is. Of course, I would have prepared to continue with my lighting job, but I didn't get too bored or tired. Rafa made me welcome from the very beginning, and being aware of my problem, tried to be patient with me. I tried to do my best too. After the hardest months are over, Begonia and I were better together than ever before. We ate together and sometimes, after having dinner, watched a rented movie. Once in a while I went to Hombre, and Begonia used to tell me that they were optimistic about my future. Apparently I was doing well, better than they had expected I would. Such was the confidence I had in myself, and so great was Begonia's pride, that a couple of months before I was going to finish up Proyecto, she told me that she had stopped taking the pill. I told her that I loved her more than ever, and I meant it. The day I finished at Hombre, we went out for dinner. To complete the celebration, Begonia told me that she was pregnant while we were having coffee. Mute, as if frozen in place, that's how the news left me. I noticed an air of worry on Begonia's face, and only then did I open my mouth to tell her that it was the best gift she could possibly have given me. Over the following months, I always had the feeling that I had been reborn. Every day I was amazed by the way of life I had long forgotten. The ability to enjoy little things, as well as being gratifying, was amazing. Any insignificant conversation I had with Begonia satisfied me as much as any white powder could. Yes, I often made such comparisons to myself, implying that I most certainly had cocaine in mind. Considering the incredulously arduous effect I'd made to forget it, that inability to forget seemed rather pitiful. Thankfully, I had brought the issue up at Hombre many times, so I had already learned not to obsess over it. My love for Begonia grew just as she did. I put my ear on her belly and listened to my daughter spellbound. I was increasingly sure that it was a girl. I still had no friends, but that was okay. I needed no one apart from Begonia. We used to go to the cinema or for a walk. Sometimes I even went to San Mamés, invited by Rafa, who was a huge athletic fan. And so, with Begonia's and Rafa's help, days, weeks and months went by. Being aware of the advantages of a monotonous life, I started to look forward to the future without fear. I was confident that I would be able to overcome any danger with Begonia by my side. I would overcome any trap that life might throw my way, which is why when I came across Julio yesterday, I was simply happy. It had been ages since I had last seen him, when I started working with lighting, more or less. I really went to Santucho, and it had been a long time since I had had any news about my friend's whereabouts, just as they probably heard nothing about me. Anyway, I knew that Julio was in the Merchant Navy. I had probably heard that from my mother. We came across each other in Indaucho just as I was leaving work. Even though his skin was tanned, he had a thick moustache and he had already started to go bald, I recognised him immediately. He recognised me too at once, even though my hair was very short and my clothes were completely different. We gave each other a long, firm hug. Moved, I started to talk and soon realised that he had always been my friend. It was as if we had parted the previous day and were meeting again the day after. We went to a bar. Julio was working on an oil tanker under the Maltese flag, which went from the Black Sea to the Atlantic and back again. It sounded like a tough, lonely job, but it was well paid, and as he was still unmarried, it was suitable enough for him. For one thing, he loved to come and go from place to place. He loved the freedom. For another, the ports were full of women waiting for the sailors. Having such an opportunity, why settle for just one? I didn't answer Julio's question. I remembered Begonia, but I let him carry on telling me his story. Just when he was about to tell me what the women in each port were like, we realised that our glasses were empty, and he suggested we go to another bar. I very rarely entered any bars, only ever with Begonia or Rafa, but I accepted. The first time it was me who ordered the drinks. The second time, though, Julio wanted to order. Beer, right? I agreed, but alcohol-free. Alcohol-free? Proyecto Hombre, my addiction. I had to tell him everything. He listened carefully. However, I had the impression that his eyes filled with a blend of pity and irony. After that, when I fell silent and Julio started to talk, I realised that I was right. He told me he had met many men like me at sea. He too was familiar enough with drugs, those which I knew and some which were even worse. I don't know all of them, he told me, but I always use them in moderation. I control the drugs, they don't control me. I looked at him with envy. However, Julio caught me by the neck and he brought me toward him, telling me that I was strong enough too. I'd been able to free myself from cocaine, and for him that was proof enough of my strength. He tapped my glass with his and we made a toast. To you, because what you've done is incredible. I don't know how many alcohol-free bars I drank in the bars after that. Chatting made us thirsty, and we had a lot to say, not having seen each other for so long. In fact, I thought that he was drinking too much. He would get drunk very quickly if he went on that way. "Let's have dinner," I told him. "I'm hungry." We were really at ease, and it was worth carrying on chatting calmly. We decided to go to the old town. On the way there, however, I thought of Begonia. I had told Julio that I had to phone her. He said, "Yes, call her." He knew about couples' lifestyles, which was the reason why he hadn't got married. He hated being controlled by anyone. "She's pregnant, 8 months," I told him, trying to justify myself. I called her from the restaurant. She didn't answer. I looked for a clock. I thought that she would be at her mother's or her sister's. I'd phone her later. Julio asked me to tell him about my son when I came back from the phone. I insisted it would be a girl. "Have you seen the scan?" "No, but I know it." We read the menu, and once we'd chosen what we wanted to eat, Julio asked the waitress for wine. "Water too, please," I added. As soon as he heard my order, he frowned. "Are you going to drink water with your steak? It's good to take care of your health, but hey, don't go too far. Moderation's the key to it. Didn't I explain that to you at Proyecto Hombre? Anyway, wine's natural. It isn't cocaine." Julio's advice seemed reasonable, the prudent words of a man with a lot of experience and no doubts. "Besides," he continued, "we have to celebrate the birth of your son or daughter, and we aren't going to celebrate with water, are we?" That was the decisive argument for me. All rules, even the most strict, have their exceptions. You only become a father once for the first time. Is there a better excuse than that? Suddenly, I hear a piercing noise. It sounds like a phone. It's ringing and ringing, but I'm not moving. I try to push my dream in some other direction, towards an unwavering silence. I can't. Then I try to ignore it. No use. It keeps on ringing and ringing. It insists so angrily that I'm forced to open my eyes. I hardly open them. It's as if my eyelashes were made of lead. I feel pain, and I have a headache too. My mouth and tongue are dry. What time is it? Where am I? The alarm clock says it's 8 a.m. If it's the alarm clock I've always had. So I am at home. Somehow I get up from the bed and, still asleep, start to stand up little by little. The telephone keeps ringing mercilessly, and it goes through my head right to my brain. It's painful, but I need water before anything else. Otherwise, I won't be able to speak or do anything. I go to the kitchen and hurry. Daylight hits me right in the face. I drink from the tap. That's the moment I feel able to speak. I answer with a dark yes from the bottom of my throat. I recognize Drefa's voice. He asks me where I've been and doesn't disguise the fact that he's angry. He'd been calling me up to 2 a.m. He gives me no chance to answer and tells me that I've been a father since 21:50 p.m. the night before. "How's Begonia?" "Begonia's quite well." "And the baby girl?" "You've had a boy. They're waiting for you at Gurutzeta." I have a shower, I get dressed and hurry out to look for a taxi. I'm lucky for once and get one fast. It's not easy to cross Bilbao at this time of year, and even though the driver tries to go as fast as I ask, the traffic forces him to go slowly. I look at the cars around us and at my watch from time to time, and I can't get it out of my head that I wasn't with her. When Begonia needed me most, I let her down. I want to pay the taxi driver before we stop. He understands. There are lots of people at Gurutzeta. I ask somebody wearing white. She summons me to the reception where, apparently, they'll tell me where to find Begonia. "Are you the husband?" I think the receptionist is gently reprimanding me, but I've no time to think whether I'm right about that. I find Rafa waiting for me by the door of the room. I want to open it, but he stops me. "Begonia's had a tough time. She's very weak. She needs rest. Let her sleep." "And the baby?" "Look," he starts, using the same voice he uses in the shop. The voice he uses when he says something that I won't like. "Where's my son? Has something happened to him?" "Calm down a bit, please. He's had problems. They've had to take him into a special room." "To a special room?" I almost shout. "Shut up. That's all I know. Speak to the doctor." I look from left to right for the doctor. He isn't anywhere. Unlike at the reception, there are a few people in the hospital corridors, and most of them are patients' relatives. There's no trace of white uniforms, and I get nervous, more and more nervous. As I go along the corridors, finally I find a nurse. I scare her. She's seen someone coming over to her, and she's got scared. I've seen it in her eyes. "My little son." She calms down a bit, and I think that she's understood who I am. She tells me that she's going to look for the doctor, so I should wait. That's when I couldn't bear it anymore. I shout that I've been looking for the doctor. He's our first son, he's ill, and I want to see him as soon as possible. It seems that she was scared about what I might do and tells me to follow her, that I've got to keep calm about what I'm going to see. These newborns are so fragile, and even the ones who look bad are going to recover over time. So that's what I do. I follow her as if I've got a weapon held to her back so that she can feel my breath on her neck. There's something I can't read when the frightened nurse opens the door. I see a long room with cradles on each side of the room, close together and almost dimly lit. Suddenly, two words come to me. Death Row, that short film I made about Texas. I feel like a prisoner condemned to die in the electric chair, walking along the corridor that takes me to my death. My knees shaking, I can hardly walk. There are babies to the right and the left who would scare anybody. They're more like tiny monsters than babies. They're disfigured bodies. Some of them have heads bigger than their chests, and some are the opposite. Others are missing an arm or a leg. They're the ones who have more than two. It's a terrible spectacle, a museum of monsters. I follow the nurse, but I want to run out of the room. I've seen too much. I don't even want to know what our baby is like, whether he has something extra or something missing. It's my fault he was born that way, to remind me every day of what a piece of shit I am. My wife giving birth in hospital while I was getting drunk. It's obvious. Rubbish can only create rubbish.